Welcome to the next installment of the Science Progress interview series. I'm Assistant Editor Andrew Pratt, and today we are talking with David Michaels, who is an epidemiologist and the director of the Project on Scientific Knowledge and Public Policy at the George Washington University School of Public Health. And Professor Michaels is the author of a new book called Doubt Is Their Product: How Industry's Assault on Science Threatens Your Health. Thanks for joining us, Professor Michaels. How are you?
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, this book is, a long and detailed history of what has gone wrong with how industry treats science throughout the 20th century up until the present day.
Well, not too long, I hope.
Hopefully not too long. Well, let me just start off by asking, when did you know that you needed to write this book, and why?
That's interesting. During the Clinton administration, I served as the Assistant Secretary of Energy for Environment, Safety, and Health. Basically, I was responsible for the health of workers, the communities, and the environment around the nation's nuclear weapons factories, some of the most polluted and dangerous places in the United States. One of the hazards I had to address was beryllium. That's an extremely toxic, lightweight metal. It's used in the manufacture of our nuclear weapons. We had workers who were getting chronic beryllium disease, which is a terrible, often deadly disease, after extremely low exposures. We had an accountant who got sick after working for a very brief time in a building in which beryllium had been used several years earlier.
Mm.
Now, in the Clinton administration, really under the leadership of then Secretary of Energy, now New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson, we issued a beryllium protection rule that's 10 times stronger than the one that was used by the Occupational Safety and Health Administration for private sector workers. But as we were developing this rule, the beryllium industry submitted studies that I saw really as attempts to obscure the issue. Instead of acknowledging that the old standard wasn't adequately protected, they focused on what we didn't know. They clearly wanted to delay our more protective regulation. Now, of course, we didn't let their report stop us, and we issued strong regulation. But I continued to be interested in beryllium after leaving the Clinton administration. So, answer your question, if there was an aha moment, it was probably when searching through the tobacco archives, which are millions of pages of previously secret documents put up on the web as a result of the big tobacco lawsuits, I discovered the same scientists who were manufacturing uncertainty for the beryllium industry were doing the same thing for the cigarette manufacturers.
Wow. And that's one of the key themes that you end up talking about, is that manufacture of uncertainty. And so one of my other questions is, can you talk a little bit about the different kinds of methods that industry uses to create this uncertainty where it didn't exist before?
Yes. I mean, I talk about in the book something I call tricks of the trade, which are tricks that one can do as a scientist if you know how to do them, essentially to turn positive studies into negative ones, or to take one positive study and do a literature review, which buries the positive studies in a whole mass of essentially garbage, so it looks like there's nothing there. And comedian Lily Tomlin once said, "No matter how cynical you become, it's never enough to keep up." I see these same techniques and these same approaches across the scientific literature, and not just in terms of chemical hazards, but it's used by the deniers of global warming, the people who are essentially fueled by the big oil and coal companies, trying to say that humans aren't causing global warming. After finding the initial information, I dove into the scientific literature and court records and dockets where corporations and trade associations file comments with agencies, and I found the same names, the same tactics, the same alchemy in campaigns run by all these different industries. And I found some very powerful smoking guns, the sales pitches made about how these product defense firms, essentially they boasted how they were able to delay regulation, what they needed to do, how they needed to change scientific studies around. I found one, for example, around Freon, which we know causes a hole in the ozone layer, how the Hill and Knowlton company was saying, well, we were able to essentially delay regulation for a couple of years when working for DuPont on this. And so what I've done is I've put all these smoking guns up on our website, which is www.defendingscience.org, so anyone can download them and read exactly how these people work.
Well, let me ask you, this is obviously there are certain tricks of the trade like you're talking about. How can other scientists who are working in related fields like you are, or policymakers or journalists who may be covering regulated industries, how can they learn to spot these particular tricks?
It's very tough, and you have to be somewhat of an expert in the field. You know, I see the epidemiology immediately, but I have much more trouble with the toxicology. So I think, you know, given that it's difficult to do, that a layperson can't just pick it up, it's very important that, first of all, scientists who are in the field, who see these problems, write letters about them and, you know, put critiques up on the web. But I think the other thing, which is sort of more fundamental, is to essentially have a screen, which is around conflict of interest. We know the basic problem is that scientists who are paid to find a certain result will find that result. And that's certainly what we see in these studies over and over again, that scientists working for these companies that essentially manufacture uncertainty never find the result the sponsor doesn't want. So one thing that we should be demanding on the part of our scientific journals and also on the regulatory agencies is to ask who paid for the study and under what contract these studies were done. If they were done, you know, with a secret contract, is often the case, or a contract that says, the sponsor has the right to see the results before they're published, well, those studies immediately should be in question, and they should be looked at much more carefully.
And there is research as well on this funding effect that shows, there's research demonstrating this link between who's paying for research and the results of it, correct?
That's true, and we see that across the board. We saw it in tobacco. We see it all over the pharmaceutical literature, most recently in bisphenol A, this plastic chemical that's used in baby bottles. There are well over 100 studies done. There's a small handful paid for by the producers, the chemical companies making bisphenol A. All those studies show no effect. But 90% of the studies done by scientists independent of these corporations find an effect. And it's very powerful. And so we know that we really, to trust a study, it should be done independently.
Certainly. Well, let me ask a question about sort of the angle that some of those government scientists might be coming from. You write a bit about how the sustained assault on scientific integrity under the Bush administration has actually demoralized a whole lot of really good scientists who are working for the federal government. And actually, shortly after your book came out, the Union of Concerned Scientists released another survey revealing that about 60% of the respondents of career scientists at the EPA had personally experienced political interference with their work in the past 5 years. And so my question is, you know, what from your perspective is the toll of this interference and this manufacturing of uncertainty on scientists, and how can we make sure that the government has good researchers in the future?
It is a significant problem. As you've said, the morale of government scientists has plummeted. Our best scientists chose to work in government because they see, or at least they saw, public service as a higher calling. They want to help in the nation's efforts to improve human health, to protect the environment. Now many of them feel they can no longer make a contribution to the public good in their current job, and they're getting out, or they're just, you know, they're fading away. They've become marginalized. We have to reverse this trend by making public service an appealing career choice again. I think we have to do this on two levels. The first, in some ways the more obvious one, is to set up structures and policies that ensure that government scientists will be respected and listened to, that they can publish their studies, that they can meet with other scientists, they can get training that they need to keep up. We need, of course, the best scientists in the country. You know, when one of our regulatory agencies has to go nose-to-nose with a multi-billion-dollar chemical or pharmaceutical company, they need to have the best scientists. They can't have scientists who can no longer go to scientific meetings to keep up with their field. So we have to, obviously, make the job of scientists one that good scientists want to go into. But on a more fundamental level, we have to change the national view of government work. Idealistic young scientists should feel the call to public service. You know, in the past, President Franklin Roosevelt and John F. Kennedy called young professionals and activists to serve their country. Our next president needs to make public service a desirable career goal, not just joining AmeriCorps or the Peace Corps, but signing up with the EPA or the Justice Department with the understanding that they'll work there for multiple years. And this should be, we should see this as an important part of any homeland security program, because it is our future and our children's future.
Wow, no, that's a really powerful idea. Well, let me go back to what you were saying a moment ago about how scientists need to push back against this manufactured uncertainty. You know, how can people who are working in scientific fields or who are writing about them or dealing with policy, what are the ways that we can present all these ideas without necessarily getting into the complexities of the science or of the regulatory policy, which can sort of confuse people and shift things into other debates?
It's very tough, but one thing that I've seen people start to do is essentially come together as scientists to look at the scientific literature, to step back for a minute and say, okay, here's a new chemical that, not a new chemical, here's a chemical that, that is in our environment. We're very interested in this. There are studies being produced by government scientists, by university scientists, by corporate scientists. There are a group of us, let's say, at any one university town, at any one university, who are interested in learning how to look at these problems. Let's come together. Let's look at the literature almost as a journal club. Let's get together and say, okay, what do we think of this? What do we think of the interpretations done by these different groups of scientists? And start writing themselves, put it up on a blog post, and weighing into the discussion. A scientist can do that with a lot of credibility, and they bring a lot of expertise because there are so many toxic chemicals out there that the producers of these chemicals can hire scientists to create fictions about whether or not they're dangerous or safe. But there are independent scientists who don't take those issues on because they're often not funded to do so. So just as volunteers, I think that's something we could do, sort of little chemical investigation groups.
Certainly. Well, let me back up and ask another question about one of the tricks of the trade that you point out, which seems pervasive, which is reanalysis of existing data in order to come to different conclusions than what a particular study might have come to. This part of the problem here has to do with access to raw data from scientific studies. And the FDA is one particular agency that does generally have access to raw data from studies when they're making decisions about pharmaceuticals. Can you talk a little bit about why access to raw data is so important in combating these nefarious reanalyses?
Well, it's a fascinating issue. There's an unequal playing field. Essentially, there was a law passed by Congress in the late 1990s called the Shelby Amendment, which gives public access, which makes public access to raw data by any study done by the government or paid for by the federal government, done by, say, a university scientist. And so what has happened over and over again is that corporations have gotten this raw data and then paid mercenary scientists to reanalyze the data and essentially make positive results go away. If you have raw data, you can do that. Now, the FDA also understands that the interpretations done by scientists paid by drug companies, you know, can't absolutely be trusted. They want to do the analyses themselves. So the FDA says, give us the raw data when you're looking at a drug's efficacy or safety, and we'll analyze it ourselves. But for other agencies, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration or parts of the EPA, for example, companies submit studies, and the agencies have to rely on the interpretations done by essentially the corporate scientists. Those corporate scientists, or mercenary scientists in some cases, have access to the raw data done by the scientists paid for by the universities and by the government. And so you have this unequal playing field where the raw data of some studies are available, yet important studies that are produced by corporations can't be reanalyzed. And so given that you have this sort of unequal, you know, playing field, we think everybody's data should be made available in a way that, you know, any researcher should be able to look at those studies, but under certain conditions. Essentially, they have to be able to say, not we're going to go fishing and try to figure out how we can manipulate these studies to make a positive result disappear, but we're going to set our hypotheses out in advance. We're going to say these are the methods and this is how it's going to work in consultation with the people who wrote the studies. And then everybody can essentially play equally in the same field.
Well, let me ask another question about federal rules that impact this playing field. You devote an entire chapter of your book to discussing what you call the most important Supreme Court case that you've never heard of, which is Daubert versus Merrill Dow Chemical or Pharmaceuticals, which gives trial judges the responsibility to determine the quality of scientific testimony from expert witnesses. And could you sort of explain why this is a problem when we're talking about public health? And
yes, it's an interesting problem because the Supreme Court ruled in 1994 that judges must decide whether the expert testimony to be given in court cases is relevant and reliable. Now, most judges have no scientific training, and they're very much influenced by the attorneys, in many cases corporate attorneys, who weigh in saying, you know, don't believe this study, this is junk science, don't let it in. And so in some cases, what judges are doing are saying, well, this evidence doesn't look like makes any sense to me, I'm not going to let it in. That ends the court case, and people who are suing a manufacturer of a dangerous product or a polluter essentially lose their case at that point. litigation, court cases are a very important part of our public health protection system, especially now in the Bush years when the regulatory agency has been handcuffed. There are numerous examples I talk about in the book of hazards which are under control only because we have lawsuits, because the regulatory agencies really aren't doing much. So you have a system now where the judges, in many cases very sympathetic to corporations, are using the Daubert decision as an opportunity essentially to stop certain evidence from getting to juries so they can decide whether or not an injury is caused by a toxic substance. Now, in some cases, they're very well-meaning, but I think, that it would be much more reasonable to let a jury decide whether or not the evidence that, you know, some toxic exposure caused an illness. The judges don't have a particular expertise in this, and it's too easy, essentially, for them to throw evidence out. And so I write about that quite a bit. It's not a very well-known decision, but it's a very important one. And I think it does have a big impact on public health.
Certainly, certainly. Well, we've covered a whole range of issues, but let me sort of back up and ask you, for policymakers or journalists or anyone else who might be listening to this conversation, what do they most need to understand about the way that industry may manufacture uncertainty in dealing with science and public health?
Well, I think they have to see that this strategy, which tobacco came up with, which is now, is now so widely used that we have to expect it. Whenever independent scientists create some new information that shows a potential link between a toxic chemical or something else and human health or the environment, you expect to see the immediate response saying, we've looked at this carefully, it's not there, more research is needed. You'll hear the call for sound science, when in fact I think they're looking for something that sounds like science but isn't. And I think what has to be done is that the public, the press, legislators should demand independent evaluation of studies, that you can't trust interpretations, you can't trust studies essentially done by sponsors who have an interest in the outcome, and that's the bottom line.
Well, that makes good sense. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us.
It's a great pleasure.
Well, we really appreciate it. Again, we've been talking with David Michaels, who is the author of Doubt Is Their Product. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Andrew.